That's it's a piece of architectural sensationalism. That's according to Frank Lloyd Wright. We know it. It's our perhaps Australia's most loved and recognisable building, Sydney's biggest billboard, according to some. It is synonymous, I think, with the culture of this place, the Sydney Opera House. 45 years now in the thick of its anniversary, and we're going to dive into the long story of that place, how it came to be, and it's been set down by Helen Pitt. And Helen has a dramatic backstory of the Opera House in her book, The House, out now and in shops. Helen, welcome.
Hi, how are you, Jonathan?
What's your personal connection, Sydney Opera House?
Well, I've been a journalist for 32 years in Sydney. I began as a journalist at the Sydney Morning Herald in 1986, but really it was the backdrop of my childhood, and that is why I wrote the book. I was an eight-year-old 45 years ago on the day it opened, and I was with my family on a chartered ferry out on the very choppy, windy Saturday that the Queen came to cut the big red ribbons that hung from the two biggest shells. So I have this sort of really vivid memory of being a kid and watching this thing be opened, and it was really a spectacular day. I'll always remember it as one of my favourite ever Sydney days. You know, there was a huge thing called the Big Flap, which was all the pigeons and the white doves that were let loose that as soon as the ribbons were cut, and the balloons that were let up into the air, 60,000 of them, and it was so blustery they kind of like zoomed straight out to the heads, and just the whole kind of feeling of celebration in the city. It was extraordinary, and there were people out on the harbour in bikinis and on surfboards and little yachts, and I'd never seen that many people, I think, together in the one place. And then there was this thing called the 2-minute cock-a-doodle, which actually signalled that the thing was
cock-a-doodle.
Open. And it was just everyone on the harbour let off a horn of some description. And it was like a massive, you know, birthday party celebration back then. So it was really kind of an impressionable thing for me as an eight-year-old. So it's really a fond memory.
Absolutely. And a real rich sense there too of how what that must have felt like for the city and for the country. And it had been such a long gestation. It had been such a troubled path to get to that moment. You can sort of understand the expressiveness of that celebration and that final moment of completion.
Yeah, indeed you could. You know, there'd been two decades of talking about it, 14 years of construction, about four premiers and $102 million spent on the thing. So my parents, like most Sydneysiders, were very eager to get a glimpse inside this thing that they had spent countless dollars on in the form of Sydney Opera House lottery tickets. So they felt like a lot of Sydneysiders, I think, that they had a really sort of big ownership on this building and were very, very keen. And another sort of personal reason was my parents went on an early date to the Art Gallery of New South Wales to see the entries in the competition, in which a very young and kind of inexperienced Dane by the name of Jorn Utzon was selected as the man to fulfil the design on the spot at Bennelong Point. So they followed it a bit like we are following the royal tour at the moment. I think the ins and outs of it. It really was a fascinating story, and it's a sort of interesting symmetry that Prince Harry is going to be the person that will celebrate the 45th anniversary here on Saturday. That the fact that his grandmother opened it 45 years ago.
Yes, that's lovely.
Interesting.
The original design sketches you mentioned Utzon's work there. I mean, they were a pretty simple affair.
They were simple to the point of being diagrammatic, was what the four judges said. So what happened was there were four judges, two from Australia, two from abroad. And the one that came in from abroad, from America, was a man by the name of Eero Saarinen. And he arrived late. There was going to be 10 days of judging, and he arrived on day five. The other three had been sifting through the 233 entries that had come from all over the world from the Monday, and he arrived on the Friday. So he sort of lobs in and starts having a look through everything that they've got in terms of the ones that they'd narrowed down for a selection. And he wasn't that impressed, so he decided to go back and have a look at the rejects that were leaning against the wall. And he just flicked through them, and he found this one that he just liked the shape of. He didn't know the name. In fact, none of the judges knew the name of any of the entrants when they were choosing
blind
them.
Tasting.
Completely blind, although he possibly recognised the style of a fellow Scandinavian, because Eero Saarinen was born in Finland and he was the son of one of Finland's most famous architects. And they migrated to the Midwest in the mid-20s, in an era where the Midwest was expanding with extraordinary architecture, you know, skyscrapers and all sorts of design buildings going on for General Motors Group, which was what he was best known for designing in Michigan. So he was pretty well known in America. He'd been on the front of Time magazine in 1956, and he was, you know, the man's man of modernism. He'd done the Gateway Arch in St. Louis, Missouri, and was really renowned in America. So in he floats on this last day, and he flicks through the rejects and pulls out this one that, you know, kind of looks a bit like sails and clouds and swan's wings and all sorts of things. And he says rather boldly, "Gentlemen, here is your opera house." And this kind of stuns the other three, because they are thinking there's not much to it. So what he did, when he prosecuted the case against the other three after the 10 days of judging, he went back to the hotel room and sketched it out more thoroughly in a way to help show Premier Joe Carl, who was going to be making the announcement to the public, what it would look like in a more thorough version. And so also what the other judges did was, once they had selected this one, they went back to a University of Sydney architect by the name of Arthur Baldwinson and asked him to draw a watercolour with it more thoroughly etched and placed on the spot in Bennelong Point. So those two reasons really were the things that convinced the people that they were their decision, but it was helpful to help the public understand what it would look like.
That's
in
quite
its spot.
A campaign. I wonder when Utzon first, you know, doodled the concept. He didn't really have a sense of how that could be realised.
He had no idea how to do it. And I think Saarinen did, actually, because he was working on a building that looks very much like the Sydney Opera House. It's the TWA terminal at JFK Airport. And it's actually now being remodeled, refurnished into a high-end hotel. It's a really beautiful arched building. And he knew how to do it with, you know, 2 or 3 inch concrete on the sails. But that was a much smaller version of what Utzon was planning to do on a much larger scale. So he really didn't have any idea. So when he drew it, obviously he had ideas, but the actual ways of doing it still needed to be sorted through. And it was quite fortuitous, really, that 2 days after the decision was made, sitting in London reading The Times was a man, fellow Dane, by the name of Ove Arup, who was a brilliant engineer who'd given the world the Mulberry Harbours in World War II for the D-Day landings.
Yes,
and he was a master of precast concrete. And he knew that that would be the secret to doing it. Now, Utzon was very much a fan of precast concrete. A lot of his buildings that had been undesigned but imagined used precast concrete as their base. So ultimately, Arup's teamwork with Utzon was a really sort of winning quinella, if you like, to get the thing off the drawing board, because it really took his engineering genius to be able to work with Utzon's architectural genius to be able to pull it off.
There's an old joke that Australia has one great opera house, that the buildings in Sydney, the stages in Melbourne and the car parks in Adelaide.
Oh, that's so true. It's not an opera house. Let's just remember that. And in fact, there were many opportunities to rename the thing, because, you know, it did initially begin with the large concert hall as the opera hall. It was always meant to be a multi-purpose hall in Utzon's original design.
And that's really important, because
it is. And that is why it is actually a misnomer. It is not a Sydney Opera House. It should be the Sydney Entertainment Centre or the Sydney Festival Hall or something like that, because it technically is not an opera house.
I wonder how our sense of it would change if that was the case. I wonder if it gets a little sort of, you know, romantic grandeur by being called an opera house.
You know, there were many attempts to rename it over the course of its life. And in fact, the Herald and the Women's Weekly had competitions to rename it. And there were some great names like Melody Mansion, Sirius Cove, One of my favourites was Bennelong Hall, and it's obvious diminutive Ben Hall, as in the bushranger.
Nice.
Many, many kind of funny names. And ultimately, the Premier wanted it to be the Royal Sydney Opera House, but of course that didn't happen. But it remained, he said, I've got to keep it as the Sydney Opera House because that's what the name has captured the imagination of everyone, and we just need to keep it in terms of, a branding proposition, because every time they tried to call it something else, it just kept coming back to the Sydney Opera House.
And it wasn't a construction that went smoothly. In fact, it ended utterly in tears, which brought in an Australian to finish the job, Peter Hall.
That's right. It was kind of a vexed project from the very beginning, or shall we say a polarising project from beginning, because a lot of people didn't like it at the beginning. I mean, despite the fact that we all pretty much all love it now and it's a brand more recognisable than Australia itself, it had a rather difficult beginning. And I guess I knew that, being a Sydney sider born here, I knew the story of the Danish designer who dreamt it up and departed very dramatically in the mid-60s, and then I got to say, though, I didn't know that much about Peter Hall, the man who took over the building. You know, I just thought that the overwhelming narrative was the fact that this Dane never got to see his magnificent masterpiece that's known the world over. But there's so many tragedies associated with the building that the Peter Hall one is a really major one.
Because his obscurity stung him, you know, through the remnant of his life.
It did. And he toiled away at it. He was a complete workaholic. He did it, worked very, very hard in a consortium of Hall, Todd and Littlemore, and was left with very few plans and didn't want to take it on, was forced in by the government architects to do it. Well, I mean, he could have said no, but ultimately someone had to do it. And there was an international ban, you know, world architects the world over were saying don't do it. And I think Utzon, he didn't want to leave. I think it wasn't just a fit of pique that made him depart. I really think he thought he'd be invited back. But I think he underestimated the bloody-mindedness of Davis Hughes, the public works minister, who wanted to get it complete in time. That's how they got in. The Askin government won a mandate in 1965 with a two-seat majority that was about fixing up the Opera House mess, is what it was called, a bit like the light rail.
I was going to say
at the moment, and so these infrastructure projects are really hot topics of conversation in any of our cities, but this one in particular, because it was so prominent on this point in the middle of the city of the heart and the harbour, and it was taking a long time, and I guess it wasn't necessarily Utzon's fault. It was a bit of the way that the whole thing was structured. He answered to a committee that was the client, and they were 30 people, and they took a long time. And anyone knows design by committee that needed a rubber stamp to
not to mention
everything.
The bodies like the ABC that were making tremendous demands for what should be in the performance spaces.
Many masters he had. I mean, and that's the important thing to remember, Jonathan. It was an ABC project. It was the brainchild of Eugene Goossens, who was the Sydney Symphony Orchestra conductor, and it was his idea, and he had been lobbying Charles Moses, the head of the ABC, from meeting with Joe Carl to convince him that this is what the city needed, because he wanted a better performing space than the Town Hall for his orchestra. He vowed on his arrival in 1947, which is around the time of the peak of Don Bradman's era, he vowed to make his orchestra more famous than the Australian cricketers. So he was on a personal mission to find the right performance space.
What a perfect note on which to end, that Sydney siders can thank the ABC for
indeed. Indeed, and that is very true. Thank you, ABC, for the Sydney Opera House.
Helen, thank you so very much.
Thanks, Jonathan.
Helen Pitt, her book, The House, is out now. Allen & Unwin, the publishers, and, of course, the Opera House. It's in the throes, the thick of its 45th birthday right now.